Anyone game for raw bison kidneys for dinner? Dana Goodyear joins us to talk about anything that moves. Her new book on renegade chefs, fearless eaters, and the making of a new American food culture.
These are, you know, really the richest eaters in the world. And what fascinated me was the way in which that group has embraced the foods of poverty in an attempt to broaden the sense of what is edible.
What has my life meant? Where did I go right and wrong? Daniel Menaker, a former editor at The New Yorker and Random House, asks the big questions in his new memoir, My Mistake.
The writing came out of necessity. Because of my brother's death, I think psychologically I started to write about that. And then little by little, I just started to write other things because it was seemingly necessary.
Julie Bosman joins us with Notes from the Field, and Greg Coles has bestseller news. This is Inside the New York Times Book Review. I'm Pamela Paul.
This podcast is brought to you by Audible.com, the internet's leading provider of audiobooks with more than 150,000 downloadable titles across all types of literature, including fiction, nonfiction, and periodicals. For a free audiobook of your choice, go to audible.com/bookreview.
Dana Goodyear joins us from Los Angeles to talk about her new book, Anything That Moves: Renegade Chefs, Fearless Eaters, and the Making of a New American Food Culture. Hi, Dana.
Hey, how are you?
Good. Thanks for joining us. So I have to ask, first of all, did you do this in a kind of I am at a remove reportorial way in which you watched other people eat anything that moves? Or were you a full sort of Mary Roach, Ted Conover participant in the in the food?
A little of both. I felt that I had to be a joiner for various reasons, one of which is when you're writing about food, you really, I think, have a responsibility to your readers to tell them what it tastes like as often as you can. I also found that reporting, I felt a little bit like an undercover drug cop or something, who if I didn't take a bite, people were very suspicious of me. I actually had people ask me if I was a government agent at one point because I was not partaking of the, I thought, kind of appalling food that was being served. But there's also sort of a code of hospitality, really, that we all recognize, I think, which is that when you're invited to eat, it's polite to take a bite. So from that point of view, I was all in and participatory, but I don't think of myself as a foodie. I think of myself as a journalist who wrote about food culture.
All right, so as a non-foodie, not necessarily a someone who eats raw bison, you know, in your free time, presumably, were there any moments where you just were truly daunted about trying what was in front of you?
Often, but I also was surprised by what I could stomach. Frankly, you know, there are things that sound really unpleasant that in actuality really aren't. Jellyfish, for example, I think a lot of people associate with, you know, being sort of a nasty that you want to avoid when you're at the beach. And in fact, I found jellyfish to be totally delicious and not threatening in any way, sort of like having a plate of al dente cellophane noodles and a sesame soy vinaigrette, which I thought was wonderful. So more often I had the experience of being surprised by what tastes good.
It's very hard for me to relate to this. I worked in a Turkish restaurant when I was 14, and it was on my first day on the job. I decided not to eat meat ever again and haven't since. Just that visceral first, you know, connection with the raw bloodiness of it all.
It's interesting that you mention that because I think that a lot of meat culture in America right now, which on the surface seems so gung-ho and maybe a little bit macho. Actually, when you talk to the people who are the loudest voices in that movement, you find that they're really just trying to get people to confront what meat is. And if that turns more people vegetarian, then that's fine too.
It's interesting you bring up the word macho because it strikes me that there is a lot of machismo in this whole adventure eating enterprise. Did you find that that was a big strand? I mean, and are a lot of the people that are interested in this kind of very frontier of food movement men?
This is a deep issue and to some people problem in the food world. I think there is definitely an attitude of thrill seeking and kind of testosterone driven aspect to the food movement right now. To me, that part of it is okay, because even though sometimes the jokes are a little juvenile or there are certain moments where, you know, you may feel a little bit put off, there is, to me, this greater good that's being served, which is that food and an interest in food is being made safe for all people. It's not a feminizing interest anymore. And once we are a country, which I believe is, you know, sometime a few years from now, when we are a country where, you know, our food culture is a little bit more mature and developed, and we are all thinking often about where our food comes from and what it means to us and putting it in the center of our lives, I think, you know, we'll have a more interesting food culture at that point. There are other issues about the male dominance in the food world that I think are real problems. And that's, you know, the glass ceiling for female chefs, for example, and things that have been brought up recently that I'm thinking, of course, of the Time magazine scandal of, you know, the underrepresentation of women in positions of power in the food world.
Did you feel, as a woman reporting on this, that, you know, yeah, I'll eat the testicles? Or did you feel like you had to kind of prove yourself that you were reporting this in a thorough way?
I've probably always been proving myself a little bit by saying, yeah, I'll eat that. But it's really also a feeling that no food should be off limits to me because of my gender. It's interesting to me to try food because it says something about the culture that is serving it. It is thought-provoking. It's often tastes great and is satisfying. So I don't abide by the gender-based taboos with food culture. And in general, in the book, I try to explore what some of our American taboos are about different foods and understand what might be at the root of those taboos.
I thought it was a very interesting that this is specifically about a new American food culture, because of course in various countries of the world a lot of this food is kind of par for the course. I remember when I lived in Thailand, it was very often in restaurants that served buffet style that there would be platters of multiple kinds of insects that were just part of the daily protein or occasional protein. Is part of this globalization? Is it part of the sort of scarcity issue that these things are entering American food culture?
I think it's anxiety about scarcity. We may not be at the point of actual scarcity yet, and certainly a lot of the diners that I spend time with in the book have access to whatever food they might want. These are, you know, really the richest eaters in the world. And what fascinated me was the way in which that group has embraced the foods of poverty in an attempt to broaden the sense of what is edible. And I think that comes out of anxiety about food security in the future.
There's something a little bit odd about the, you know, these very wealthy people sort of and chefs and restaurant owners going and eating, as you say, the food of poverty. But what's interesting, too, is that the food of poverty is often the food of poverty in other countries, as opposed to the food of poverty that is the true food of American poverty, fast food. So there's just some interesting contradictions in terms of sort of what is authentic.
And there's, you know, the 20th century in American food production made us focus on a narrow band of species, and it focused really intensively on those species, and it made food very cheap, and it also, to a lot of people's minds, was an experiment that went off the rails.
There are two, it seems, different kinds of deprivation, sort of food deprivation. On the one hand, you have people who are, you know, taking things out of their diet, whether it's a vegan diet or a gluten-free diet or a, you know, raw diet on the one hand. And then what you're talking about more, which is, you know, going for assuming that everything else doesn't exist and having to go for insects and plants that normally aren't eaten, other animals that aren't usually eaten. It's a very strange phenomenon either way, and I'm wondering what you make of it, and are those two movements related?
It's a fascinating question. I mean, I'm starting to hear about people who are vegan except for the meat that they hunt. And it seems to me that there is an attempt among the people I write about to turn back the clock back to just to the pre-industrial time, just to before the turn of the 20th century. So that's the sort of hyper-artisanal movement and the cottage food style movement, and you know, pretending that mass production and the refrigeration, the cool chain doesn't exist. Then there are those who are trying to turn back the clock even farther, that sort of before domesticated agriculture, and that's the more the primal diet types, and also the kind of deprivation dieting that you're talking about is all happening in the context of excess that may not last, and that's where the anxiety piece comes in again, which is, we're aware that we are wasteful, and we're aware that we are able to do whatever we want in terms of food, essentially, and the, you know, the anorexia of the rich, you might call it.
Right.
But there is a looming sense of the unsustainability of the ways we've been eating. So sometimes it feels to me that the way the avant-garde is anticipating a future that hasn't quite happened yet. And sort of preparation.
End times
preparation. And, you know, so often these tasting menus really look like they could come out of, you know, survivalist handbooks from the military. You know, what happens when you're dropped down deep into enemy territory and you have to live in the woods for 4 months.
And the mentality of this kind of pre-industrial food seems tied in certain ways to efforts to sort of strip our lives of many aspects of modernity, whether it's building your own houses or foregoing hospital births or vaccination, but that in all of these, that there are risks. And you talk about some kind of dangerous eating that goes on there. I mean, not just sort of possibly repulsive, but actually perhaps life-threatening.
Yes. Writing the book actually tuned me into my own risk sensitivity, which, you know, before I had this sort of sense of, well, I'll try it once. And then I realized that there are things being offered in this universe of foodism or foodism that actually I won't try. And that the more I learn, the more comfortable I feel with my supermarket choices sometimes. But there are legitimate risks to what I think of as unofficial foods from unofficial sources, unregulated, this sort of underground, sometimes illegal.
Right, you talk about illegal whale and
raw milk, I think is a big one. That's a big hot button. Raw milkers are some of the most impassioned food activists out there. And they would point out that there are also risks with food that is totally sealed, stamped, and legitimate. And what I see happening is this is a big inversion. And so that the most committed and in some ways progressive and obsessive eaters, there's a sense that what's official is impure and what's pure is the stuff that you're not supposed to get. This is a big undermining of the regulations that were set in place following the revelations of Upton Sinclair's The Jungle in 1906. That novel tipped the scales on legislation that had been, some people had been trying to get passed for already a generation, but the public became so alarmed by what they learned in that novel, and it was checked out by government investigators, and most of it was found to be true. This idea that, you know, what was on the label is not what was in the can, and that the laws, the Pure Food and Drug Act that gave rise to the modern FDA and USDA, were meant to bring people back in touch with their food and give them confidence that they were eating what they thought they were eating. And a lot of people in the food movement feel that that is an experiment gone awry, that in fact that regulation and those sort of layers of regulation just institutionalized and entrenched a kind of industrial food that completely alienates the consumer
right.
from the food.
Earlier you talked about the surprising yumminess of jellyfish. But before we go, I have to ask you, what did you try that you were just not won over? What was the most awful thing you ate in the course of your research?
I have to say that for me, and this had nothing to do with the taste, actually, but the dish that I will probably never try again is the balut, which is the Filipino delicacy. It's a duckling unhatched inside its shell, cooked in the shell. You peel the shell off and then you eat it whole, the duckling and the egg. You know, from the point of view of flavor, these are all familiar flavors. There's sort of a chicken broth scent to it, and the meat tastes like a lot of organ meat that you've had, or the dark meat on any bird, any poultry. Psychologically, that one was almost an insurmountable hurdle.
Ducklings.
Exactly. I felt that, you know, it was sort of the perfect diet food. I didn't want to eat for the rest of the day. It was something that I would probably only try again if I were actually starving. So for me, it really was post-apocalyptic food.
So there's the trick. Your book can be marketed as a diet book.
Sell millions of copies.
That's right. Dana, thank you so much.
Thank you very much. It was fun talking to you.
That was Dana Goodyear, author of Anything That Moves, Renegade Chefs, Fearless Eaters, and the Making of a New American Food Culture.
This podcast is brought to you by Audible.com, the internet's leading provider of audiobooks with more than 150,000 downloadable titles across all types of literature and featuring audio versions of many New York Times bestsellers. Audible is offering listeners of this podcast a free audiobook when you try Audible free for 30 days. One audiobook to consider is The Bully Pulpit, Theodore Roosevelt, William Howard Taft, and the Golden Age of Journalism, written by Doris Kearns Goodwin. That's The Bully Pulpit by Doris Kearns Goodwin, and it's available on Audible. For a free audiobook of your choice, go to audible.com/bookreview. That's audible.com/bookreview.
Julie Bosman is here. Hi, Julie.
Hi, Pamela.
What's going on out in the publishing world?
There was an interesting discovery in the publishing world this week. We learned that Yale University has authenticated a manuscript that they believe is the first prison memoir written by an African American, and the manuscript was dated 1858.
And where was he in prison?
This is an interesting story. So the author, whose name was Austin Reed, but who wrote under the name Robert Reed for reasons that are unknown, was born in Rochester, New York, as a free man, and was imprisoned in Auburn Prison, which is now known as Auburn State Penitentiary. But this is a prison that was founded in 1816 and has a pretty interesting history. It was known as kind of a progressive prison at his time in the 1850s, which at the time meant that prisoners were kept in their own solitary cells with no lights and no windows, and they were not allowed to speak to one another.
As opposed to
a more communal experience. So this was a prison that was this was considered a very humane way to treat prisoners, even though it seems appalling to us now. And there were very strict punishments. Prisoners were frequently whipped. Prisoners were subjected to something called the shower bath, which is really just a precursor to waterboarding, where they were strapped into a booth and buckets of water were poured over their head. And actually, prisoners died of it. So it's those conditions that were recorded in this manuscript written by Austin Reed. And it was 300 pages, and it was titled The Life and Adventures of a Haunted Convict.
Now, presumably, he wrote this after he got out of prison.
Actually, they believe it was written while he was in prison because it was dated 1858 and he wasn't released from prison until after that. Now, I spoke to people who know this prison very well and know the history of it, and they say that it does seem possible that he wrote this in prison. He would have learned to read and write while he was at the New York House of Refuge, which was really the first reform school for teenagers in New York State. And he spent time there as a young man, was sort of the like a juvenile delinquent home. So he went there, and then after a series of petty thefts, money and that kind of thing, he was sent to Auburn. Now, he spent almost three decades at Auburn, on and off, and he would have written this manuscript with no light and in very difficult conditions. But it is possible that he had access to some reading materials, and he even may have been encouraged to read and write by some of the prison officials.
Is this something that's going to be published by Yale University?
It is going to be published if the scholars at Yale have their way. I think that they're shopping it around as we speak. The book is being prepared for publication. Caleb Smith, who is a professor of English at Yale, and he was one of the people who worked on authenticating the manuscript, is working on polishing the manuscript right now. He's going to write an introduction or a preface, and I think that they are shopping it to major publishers right now.
Where did they find it?
It's interesting. This was years ago, a rare books dealer who lives in Rochester was at an estate sale in that area, and he found the manuscript and bought it. And this is someone who works as a lawyer and as his main job. And he ended up selling it in a catalog in 2009. It was listed in a catalog, and that's when Yale bought it.
All right.
So we don't really know where it was for all that time, for those 150 years. It seems that it had never left upstate New York, and the family that sold it at this estate sale said very little about where they had gotten it and where it had been. So it's a mystery.
This has been really quite a year for discovered manuscripts.
It is.
So we'll see what 2014 brings. Thanks so much, Julie.
Thanks.
Daniel Menaker joins us now to talk about his new memoir, My Mistake. Hi, Dan.
Hi. Glad to be here.
This book is a lot of things. It's a very personal story about you and your family, also a workplace story, a New York story about the New Yorker, a publishing world book, something that I feel like everyone here at the Book Review and probably many people at the Times will have already read or want to read. Was it hard for you to go into? I feel like there's like a whole subgenre of My Time at the New Yorker books. Is that a
true
kind of daunting thing to?
Well, yes. And in fact, I think I've read all of them. I got a very nice note from David Remnick, the current editor, who complimented me on the book and said he thought he'd read every single word that was ever written about the magazine, and proceeded to use some superlatives for mine, which I was very gratified by. It is daunting to think how many books have been written about the New Yorker, but I think this one's different. I think that it comes at it from an insider point of view, as do many others. The others tend to be hagiographical. This is a little bit more balanced, I think. And also, it comes from the point of view of an outsider. I never really felt at home at the New Yorker for various reasons, although I was certainly part of it for a long time.
It's funny because you talk about the reason, the thing that sort of got you interested in working there. It reminded me of, someone did a video story at the Times earlier this week in which the assistant to Joanna Coles at Cosmopolitan Magazine says that he wanted that job because he had seen The Devil Wears Prada. And,
right.
You know, you think, well, who would want the job after seeing that? And you talk about wanting this job after having read Tom Wolfe's.
Well, I wanted actually to have, I had an idea about working there even before that because for two reasons. For one thing, my mother was an original subscriber in 1925, so the magazine was always around the house. And the second reason is that I was first published in The New Yorker when I was 9 years old. And that was from an anecdote that happened at the Little Red Schoolhouse on Bleecker Street, where I went to school, where the teacher asked the students what the names of the three ships that Columbus sailed over in were. And one little girl raised her hand and said, Atchison, Topeka, and the Santa Fe. And I went home and told my parents that, and they asked me to write it up and send it to the New Yorker. So in the Talk of the Town in 1948, you will see a piece by me. So I started actually fairly early.
That's probably, is that the earliest? That's, were you the youngest
you
writer
what?
Ever? In
maybe
the...
so. I don't know. Maybe E.B. White started when he was four. I'm not sure.
If anyone did, then it was him. Your mother, of course, was a magazine person.
She was a magazine editor at Fortune.
And what did she think of this path, this chosen path of yours?
I think she was very proud. I think both my parents were proud of the work that I did. I ended up being able to do. There was a very rough patch about 2 or 3 years after I got there, but I was asked to find another job. I wasn't fired, and I, being a sentence freak, thought, well, they've asked me to find another job, which isn't quite the same thing as get out.
Right.
So I hung on.
Go somewhere else as opposed to leave. But you did eventually leave.
I did leave. When Tina Brown arrived for about a year and a half, I remember when Charles McGrath called me to tell me that Bob Gottlieb was leaving and Tina Brown was arriving.
And what year is this?
That would have been 92, I believe, 1992. And I said to Chip, you and I will be gone in 2 years. And turned out to be right. I thought that the magazine changed in many ways, in some ways good, many ways, in my opinion, not so good. And when Tina's husband offered me a job at Random House, for various reasons, I felt I didn't have much choice. Also, kind of wanted to leave. She and I actually admire and like her, but I thought that the magazine had become kind of nuttier than ever. So it was just
so you
as
went
well.
To the very sane world of book publishing.
It's not the same world.
No, sane.
Oh,
I said.
Sane. Oh, I'm sorry.
A bit ironic.
Well, in a way, you know, there is a sanity about it, an ultimate business sanity, because you have to, as Alberto Vitali once said to me, you gotta move the units, professore.
Vitali being the former publisher of Random House.
And he would stop me in the hall and say, professore, we gotta move the units. He was Italian, had been the head of Olivetti. And what I mean by the sanity is at least at the heart of it, you have to satisfy commercial demands. It is a business. The insanity of it is that it is also rubs up against the desire to be part of the life of letters of a nation. So there's sort of a grinding between commerce and culture.
A clash.
Well, it's more like, I'm not to correct your metaphor, but it really, you do feel sort of ground.
Right,
because
rubbing up.
You want to buy a great book, you want to acquire it, but you're not sure what the sales will be. So that's where the rub comes.
It's interesting because you, of course, spent years at Random House and then at HarperCollins and back at Random House. People think from the outside that, oh, well, it must be so easy to write a book if you've worked in publishing. And certainly that's the way a lot of people who work in publishing hope, you know, aspiring writers who work in publishing hope it will be. But in certain ways, doesn't it make it harder?
You know, it's funny.
Like you know too much?
When I started at The New Yorker, I had no idea about being a writer. It was a very Oedipal job because my mother was an editor, and I thought, okay, I'm on this path. My brother had died, and about 2 or 3 years after that, after a very tragic accident, I began to sort of need to write. And the static of being around other editors and checkers and copy editors and so on was so loud in my head that I couldn't do it. And then it kind of died down. It began to cancel each other out, this voice and that voice. And I began, with the help of William Maxwell, to find my own, I hope. So, yeah.
William Maxwell, the legendary New Yorker editor
and
novelist.
Fiction
writer.
Editor and the person who saved my professional life.
How did he save your professional life?
Well, I was on the way out. I was looking for another job. I got an offer at the Saturday Review. It closed the next week, so that wasn't going to work.
Not good timing.
Not good timing. Mr. Maxwell seemed to take a liking to me and asked me as a copy editor to make editorial comments on the short stories that he edited. And so I did. There's a dramatic moment where I thought I was about to be in trouble again, and he said, no, please tell me what you think. So before he left, he asked William Shawn, who was the editor, to give me a chance to be an editor. And I think it may have been slightly extortionate because I believe that Maxwell might not have left so easily had Sean not acceded to his request. And so I had another purgatory to go through for about 2 or 3 years, and then things began to work out. The writing came out of necessity. Because of my brother's death, I think psychologically I started to write about that. And then little by little, I just started to write other things because it was seemingly necessary.
Your brother's death is the mistake that you refer to in the title of the book?
Probably it's the main one. We were playing touch football. I didn't want to play backfield, and I goaded him. We were 29 and 26, and it was as if we were 13 and 10. We regressed, both of us, and started spatting with each other. So he finally relented and played backfield, hurt his knee, had surgery, and got septicemia and died. So I've always felt at least part of the chain of events that led to his death.
You said that that you felt the need to write after his death. Did you write immediately about his
No,
death?
It took a couple years of being... I mean, I think the reason I was asked to leave The New Yorker is that I was psychically so screwed up. And also, it was a nutty place. So the two things didn't go well together.
You had different kinds of craziness?
Different kind of craziness. I was acting out, acting up. And I had a dream. I know you're not an analyst, but I'm going to tell you anyway. I had a dream about my brother coming back to visit our house in Nyack, which is where we went to high school. And that dream was so powerful that I woke up and I wrote the dream down and embellished it. And I gave it to Maxwell. And he came back downstairs from the 20th floor to the 19th. I was a copy editor. He put it on my desk with tears in his eyes and said, "This is wonderful, but it's not a story. You have to put a frame around it." So I did. And that was the first piece, I think, I sold to The New Yorker.
Well, the second.
That's true. Thank you. Thank you. I have
assuming
to say,
you got paid for your talk of the town at age 9.
I did. I got $50.
That's a lot of money back
and
then.
And I gave $25 to the little girl who said Atchison, Topeka, and the Santa Fe.
Wow, that's a lot more than most writers would do with their sources.
Listen, that's a real payday these days, $50. Sometimes with the provision of free content, we don't even get that.
So a lot of people, of course, move within the world of books and letters, from magazines to the book world, or from editor to writer. Do you think of yourself as primarily a writer or an editor? And do you think of yourself as a book person or a magazine person?
That's a really good question. I think of myself primarily as someone who tries not to eat cupcakes every day. I think that's my first priority. Let's see. I suppose I'd have to say editor because it absorbed the majority of my working time for 35 years. Now I'm a writer and I do some freelance editing. When I think about the number of people I worked with and the range of people I worked with, you know, that's such a good question because I think there are lots of it, as you just said, there are lots of editors who write and there are lots of writers who edit, but people who do both don't get full, I think sometimes don't get the full respect of being a writer.
Yeah.
Nor should they, because becoming a writer and devoting yourself to that calling is a real plunge. And you really have to live the life, and you have to go kind of crazy. And whereas an editor gets to go to work every day, has regular exchanges with normal people, has to kind of
on where you work.
That's true. Okay, let's say a wider range of abnormal people besides oneself. You know, John Cheever used to take a briefcase, put on a hat and a suit, and go down to the basement of his house to write.
That's fun. That's like Bob Caro does a similar thing where he gets into a tie and jacket, even though he's just into a little private office.
At least I make the bed. I'm not sure about the tie and jacket.
We all have our different standards. You wrote this book and it's coming out the same year that your wife also wrote a memoir.
Partial memoir, yes. I mean, the rest of her book, which is about hearing loss, and I think
this is
a wonderful book.
Catherine Boughton's book.
Shouting Won't Help. About her own hearing loss, but it is memoiristic, but it also has a lot of science in it. And a great many interviews with people, including an opera singer who have suffered hearing loss. She's now actively involved in that community, and she's writing another book whose subject I probably shouldn't say for fear it will somehow decrease her.
This is the professional book editor in you coming out here, not just the husbandly promotion. But
Anyway, Catherine and I are both now writing, and we sort of work in our apartment. And every time one of us goes into the other's, and I'm using quote marks, office, the other one looks up annoyed. Because if I'm not working, she is.
Right.
And if she's not working, I am.
The timing never works out.
Never works out.
Do you edit each other's work?
Oh, man. That is a delicate subject. I guess the short answer is yes, and the long answer is no. I mean, we look at each other's work. She asks me. But when she asks me to read her stuff, she says, you know, just read the whole thing. Give me a general idea. I don't read that way editorially. I start at the beginning. It's a habit of mine. I think it works well. She doesn't want to see my commas on the one hand. On the other hand, she gives global reads. So I think we have an approach avoidance situation here. Let me leave it at that.
I'm on Team Catherine because I do the same thing with my husband.
Really?
I do.
What happens?
He sometimes listens, but he's a very good editor. Well, thank you so much, Dan.
It's a great pleasure to be here. Thank you.
The book again is My Mistake, a memoir by Daniel Menaker. Greg Coles is here with Bestseller News. Hi, Greg.
Hi, Pamela.
What's new on the list?
On the hardcover side this week, there's really not a lot. Readers, it's not that they're not buying books, but they're not buying new books.
They're just buying the same ones. This was last week, too.
I did. That's exactly right. There are three new books in total on the hardcover side of things this week. Two of them are on the fiction list, and they're both near the top. One of them is at the top. It's called Command Authority. It is a new Jack Ryan novel by the late Tom Clancy. He did have a co-writer on this book. He has on his last several books. The co-writer this time around is a guy named Mark Greene, who's a novelist in his own right. The same day that Command Authority came out, Mark Greene's new book came out too, but he's only ever hit the list with his Tom Clancy books.
And do we know if part of this was done posthumously or?
No, in fact, it was 100% in the can about a week before Tom Clancy died, according to an interview with Mark Greene in a Memphis newspaper. He's a Memphis resident. He said they had just put the finishing touches on this book late September. Then Tom Clancy died on October 1st, and you know, now the book is out, and here it is leading the list. Then at number three, another series novel by Michael Connelly this time, a book called The Gods of Guilt. This is not one of his usual Harry Bosch series. It is instead a Mickey Haller book, also known as The Lincoln Lawyer, that was made into a movie recently.
Matt McConaughey.
With Matthew McConaughey, exactly. So this continues that series. And those are the only two novels new to the hardcover list this week. On the nonfiction side, then, there's just one new title, and it's down near the bottom of the list at number 14. Ben Bradley Jr., the son of the great Washington Post editor Ben Bradley, is a Boston guy. He worked for the Boston Globe for a time and has a book out that's a biography of the great Red Sox player Ted Williams. The biography is called The Kid, and that is new on the nonfiction list at number 14.
And that was reviewed by Chip McGrath.
Another great Boston guy, although he's, of course, one of ours.
One of ours.
I also did want to buzz over quickly to the combined list, the print and ebook list. On the fiction side, there's, besides the two that I already mentioned, there are kind of your normal romance things. There are three new romance titles on there. Just to name them quickly, it's Gabriel's Redemption by Sylvain Renard. I'm not sure how you pronounce that last name. That's new at number 8. At number 10, Take Me by Jay Kenner, which gets about as bold as you can in the title. And at number 15, The Ever After of Ella and Micah by Jessica Sorensen. But the reason I wanted to buzz over to the combined list here really is that the only new title on the nonfiction side of things is a book by Nelson Mandela, who, of course, just died. At number 11, new this week, it's Long Walk to Freedom, which is his autobiography. And so new interest in that in the wake of his death.
Wrote with Rick Stengel, formerly editor of Time magazine.
I did not know that. There you
go. Indeed.
All right.
Thanks, Greg.
Thanks, Pamela.
Remember, there's more at nytimes.com/books. Our producer is Jocelyn Gonzalez, and you can always write to us at books@nytimes.com. Thanks for listening. For the New York Times, I'm Pamela Paul.